Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, A Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, I want to mention our monthly guidebook slash workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your musical life and career on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from My Music Masterclass, and if you want to learn more, go to mymusicmasterclass.com, hit subscribe in the header menu, and you'll be good to go. All right, so we are here with Will Vinson, who's a great composer, saxophone player, played with a bunch of people, as you know, like Gonzalo. I don't think you need his last name. You know, it's such a cool first name, right? Ari Honig, Lage, Lund, all kinds of cats. And he's a super badass and a really cool guy. And right now, I believe you're in Australia, which is super cool because I know Joe, your wife, is from Australia.
Yes, that's right. Hi, everyone. Hi, Adam.
How is Australia? I mean, I know how it is here, and I'm sure that you know how it is here.
It's,
you know, it's strange. What's going on with COVID there, first of all?
Well, so we came here like on a real sort of whim. I just had like in March, Joe, my wife, was expecting our second child. She was like 2 months out from, delivering. And, matter was beginning to hit fans at that moment, like in the middle of March. And I just had a lizard brain moment and I was like, we got to get out of here. So we left, we got on a plane, 24 hours later to Australia and had the baby here. And we were instantly struck, or I was instantly struck by just, I mean, I know a lot of things happened very quickly in March, but by the time we got here, they were taking it really seriously. There was no, you know, the whole thing wasn't, I mean, we don't need to get into this, but it wasn't politicized. So
right. No, we can get into like, it. I don't care.
Let's do what we need to do to control the virus. And originally the goal was, you know, suppression and control. And then it ended up being elimination because they were doing so well but they did some things that would have been hard to do in the States. They closed all the borders between the states.
Right, that is
so
true.
If you were in New Jersey, you wouldn't be able to enter New York without quarantining for 14 days, you know.
Wow.
with the police checking on you. The police would be checking on you daily. When we came from New York, we had to get an Airbnb that didn't have anybody else in it, and we were in it for 14 days, and if we'd broken the quarantine, so you're not, which includes not going, you're not allowed to leave the house to go and buy groceries or anything. You have to have, jeez, you have to find some way to get groceries into your house.
Right.
It doesn't involve you leaving it. If you break it, that's a $20,000 fine, right? So they're not messing around.
Yeah.
And you can't just, you know, like go to Melbourne or, and you can't go anywhere, in fact. But we were in Adelaide, which is in South Australia, which has a pretty kind of sparse population anyway. So they had some advantages, but apart from 2 days in December when they panicked and they thought that there was an ultra communicable variant of COVID that had arrived in South Australia. And they locked down the entire population to that same level that we had been in quarantine, which it was the toughest lockdown anywhere in the world, but it only lasted 2 days because they then found out that they'd been given faulty information about how that particular infection happened. Apart from those 2 days, South Australia has never actually been in full lockdown. There's been restrictions here and there, but you can more or less do what you want. Like sometimes it's been limited to how many people you can have in your house. For a while it was none, and then it was like five. And,
wow.
And now it's like 10 or something. I don't want any more than 10 people in my house. I don't even want 10 people in my house. Thank you very much. So
matter of fact, that's why you moved to Australia.
Exactly.
It's just far away from motherfuckers as possible.
It's a socially distant place to begin with. So, and that's always been something that, I've always had difficulty with, but being here right now, it's like, okay, this is exactly where you want to be. There's been no deaths in South Australia since April.
Jeez.
There's been very few cases. I mean, like literally, two digits worth of cases.
Man.
So it's been essentially normal. And I feel simultaneously lucky and guilty for that. I also really miss my family and I miss my friends in New York, and a lot has happened in America in the last year, and I haven't been there for any of it. And that sort of feels strange too. But on the other hand, we have a new baby and we also have a 3-year-old daughter, and we would be locked down in some way, even without a pandemic. So it's kind of ideal timing. I feel really guilty saying that too, but
no, I mean, I think you're in a good spot. Have you seen the movie Death to 2020 yet?
Death to 20? No.
It's good. It's on Netflix. Charlie Booker wrote it, or,
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Black Mirror and shit. And yeah. So it equally makes fun of Trump and Boris at the same time, so it's kind of amazing, but it pretty much goes through the first sniffle to what happened, and it does it in a satirical way, of course, but I mean, it's as well as it can. But I mean, aside from all that, how is your schedule and your body dealing with two kids? Because for me, I know that I've talked to other musicians about this, like, I used to say that I was busy and I didn't have any time, and basically I didn't know what the fuck I was talking about, And now you have a kid. Yeah, like I was vetching back then, and it was completely not appropriate. Now I have no time, but you have two, so you probably have double no time. How do you get shit done and practice and do all that and everything like that at this point?
Well, I've got to be brutally honest. First of all, not much shit is getting done.
that's kind of true for everybody right now.
I think so. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people beating themselves up about how, they've ostensibly got all this time that they weren't expecting to have, and where's my symphony?
It's called anxiety.
It's not really happening. In fact, I just read a brief interview today on the SF Jazz website with Gonzalo, you mentioned, and he was talking about how, it's like, usually ordinarily we're on the road, we're just doing stuff. Like, we don't have time to focus and work and stuff. And now we just have like too much time because you can't really use it. And I mean, I'm sure some people are, and some people I'm sure are like coming up with incredible, uses of time. My time management is not terrible if I can stay focused on it. But personally, I'm sort of grateful for the fact that my project during this pandemic is childcare, because then all I have to show for it is two kids, and I don't need like I don't need to have like reinvented the wheel in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, shielding the kids. I mean, it's something that I've done as well. I mean, how old is your oldest? Is probably a little younger than mine, maybe 3 or something like that.
Yeah, she's right. 3. She's just over 3. Yeah.
So it's like, for him, he's 4 now, and being able to shield him, I mean, explain to him that people have a virus, or, in a way where it's just not horrifying, is a very big part of my job, keeping him entertained and creative. And we've been successful at it, but it's it's not like, you know, armchair parenting or whatever that, you know, it's hands on for sure, you know?
Oh God. Yeah. There's no escaping it.
No.
I mean, we did have to do a lot of that when we got here, and, you know, she was 2.5. Mm-hmm. No, she wasn't even 2.5. Like, explaining that we can't, you know, cause she has family here. My wife has almost all her family is here. Like, explaining that you can't go into people's houses. You can't hug people. It's very confusing. It's confusing for me even to to sort of live that way and trying to make sense of it with her. But, you know, as I say, like, the restrictions, a lot of the restrictions were lifted. So we don't have to deal with that on such a day to day, like, you know, moment to moment basis. When the lockdown came in December, for like 2 days, we got a reminder of what that feels like. And it felt like just as brutal the second time as it did the first time. But as far as like, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm dealing with all the same things that you deal with when you're having a kid. Okay. Oh, yeah. No, on the subject of 1 versus 2.
Yeah, please.
I mean, yeah. I don't know whether you're considering like enlarging or.
No, we're okay with our current size.
You're good. Yeah. Well, so was I. But you know, we decided, this is all getting very personal, but like, we, you know.
Don't worry, no one's going to listen to this.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
As big as any part of the, you know, decision to have two was like, we want her to have a sibling. That was it for me. Like, I found it really hard to conceptualize the idea of like having another. I spent the first 2 years of her life just doing stuff with her, like taking her places, and just the whole time thinking, how do you do this with two?
Right.
Like, because this is impossible almost with one. Like, you know, so.
It's hard. So, well, in that beginning, though, it is. I mean, just to tell anyone out there and you know, listening, it is harder or more scarier would be the proper word. Scarier in the beginning because they're so fragile and there's so much, like, you literally can't leave a small child alone for a minute, you know what I mean? As opposed to when you're four, they can play by themselves or three, you know. But anyway, go on.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, just an example, like the first year of my daughter's life, there wasn't a time when I would put her to bed, you know, like if it's me putting her to bed, when I wouldn't, you know, be wondering like 45 minutes later whether she was dead. I put her down wrong, and you know, and
totally.
So the first time,
SIDS is a big thing, you know.
Well, yeah, of course. So it's not like it's not totally unfounded, but it does get to be sort of pathological. Shit.
No, it is. But yeah.
But with the I talked to a lot of people as you're talking to me now. Like, you know, before we had the second one, I was like, okay, so. You know, talking to people who have two kids or even three kids.
Like Ari, probably. I'm sure you brought it up with him because I've had that discussion with Ari too.
With Ari, with Lage, with Orlando, right. With Fleming, with, you know, all these people. So I was like, so what's it like with two? And they were sort of evenly divided, the answers that I would get. But so on the one hand, there would be people who say, oh man, second one is like so much easier. Like they just go with the flow. They just like, it's just like everything kind of makes sense. And I didn't believe a word of that. And then the other people would be saying, yeah, it's not twice as hard. It's 10 times as hard.
Oh, I haven't heard that. I usually hear that it's like,
oh man,
half as hard because, you know.
And I just thought, I heard that the second one and I was like, yeah, that's going to be us big time. and miraculously, it's not, it's option A. He's like super chill. My daughter like loves him.
And, awesome.
And it just, I mean, it's, you know, in terms of labor, you know, in terms of just stuff you're doing, it is harder. Like there's no question about it, but in terms of just like your mental capacity to cope and also the sort of some of the joy you get is enhanced too. I mean, really, like the day my son was born, I just instantly loved my daughter like 10 times as much as I did before. I don't really know what's behind that. It's not because I didn't like him. It was just some other thing that was happening.
Yeah, it's fucked up to even say out loud.
But But it is, it's great. It's hard, but I honestly, like, and as I mentioned, I feel guilty about how comparatively easier, even though we're dislocated, like I don't have, I've got like three outfits, all my stuff is now in a storage. We got rid of our apartment in New York and all my stuff's in storage. We don't know where we live. You know, we don't know what country we live in.
It's like, you literally got rid of your place. You sold it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, because, we were actually planning on doing that anyway, but, we did that and so we don't have a permanent address now, we're in like essentially an Airbnb down here.
Yeah.
So, but that was a tangent. Yes. Feeling guilty about how fortunate our circumstances are here. On that note, we would be locked down anyway. I would be wanting to spend as much time at home as possible. Right. And this way we're doing that. And I don't have to like doom scroll on Facebook looking at all the amazing tours that everyone else is doing and thinking, oh shit. Because why.
There's nothing happening. And the problem with all this is that, the response obviously from the US has been so poor and from some other countries, but US is at the top of the badly handled list.
I would put the UK slightly above the US.
You think so?
Yeah. Because in the US,
he's a character too, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's a character, but there's an important difference between not him and Trump. I think they are effectively the same person, but between the role of prime minister in the UK and the role of president in the US, because the US is a federal republic, and the states can make their own decisions about how they want to handle this stuff. So you've seen, like look at North Dakota, and they've had the worst transmission case and numbers in the world. And then meanwhile, New York, with this dense population, has actually got a handle on it. In the UK, you can't do that.
I didn't know that.
Everything comes from centralized government.
Right, so London can't do what it wants,
they can do a few things. They can tinker around the edges, but that can work. But when you've got a government that's made up, deliberately made up of idiots who are in place because they signed on to Boris Johnson's fucking nut job Brexit program before the election.
Yeah, that was definitely
it is deliberately idiots that are in charge because he wanted yes men. And so in a situation like this, it's a disaster anyway, but in a situation like this, it's even worse. And the UK has a worse death rate than the US. And
Not a bigger number because of the sheer numbers involved. But of course
it's like 100,000. Yeah, 100,000 and versus 400,000, but the population is
much less.
A fifth of the
total
size. Anyway, whatever.
Lightening it up a little bit from that. So when did you move to the US? And you went right to New York or did you go somewhere else first?
Yeah, no, I went right to New York. I went to New York and did a master's at Manhattan School.
Okay.
In 99.
All right.
So 22 years ago, nearly.
That was after me. I was there earlier, but I didn't stay. I was there for a year.
And, you didn't stay at the school?
No, I was, I stayed there. I was at there in 94 and then I bailed.
Okay. Well, for me, I had, the whole, for foreign students, the whole visa thing is connected to the school. So
totally.
you can't just stay in New York, but quit school. So no. I kept doing it.
And back then, I'm sure it was easier and still hard. You know what I mean? I've had friends from Brazil. I've read a lot of ONA. Well, I write a lot of recommendation letters for people seeking ONA visas. And hopefully it gets easier under the new administration, but I felt for all my friends from Brazil and from, South America and wherever you're coming from, it definitely was not easy.
No, that's right. And I mean, it wasn't easy then either, but I have friends here, for example, here in Australia who live in New York, but they came to Australia, to be with their families in the pandemic, and they can't go back because they can't get their visas renewed because of Trump's blanket sort of ban on non-immigrant visas. So I think that's already been turning around. So that's good. So some of these guys are going back.
Okay, so you came in under an educational visa and just for your master's, so for a couple of years. And then, I mean, I basically wanted to ask you about this because in a perfect world where there's no COVID and eventually we'll be able to live with it, I know it won't go away, but we'll be better prepared for this kind of situation. And people will be trying to move to different countries and stuff like that. A lot of people come to America and they're musicians and...
Yeah,
it's important. It's a really cool perspective, not only moving from New Jersey to New York or Texas to New York, but to move from another country because it's, as I've talked to a lot of people that have even gotten green cards or just O1A visas, it's important to like legally do the shit or you're going to get in trouble when you get a better...
Oh my God.
Yeah, like once you get a real gig, like not like a restaurant gig, they're going to need you to... W-9 you know what I mean? 1099 or whatever it is. Yeah. So like, how did you deal with that first legally and all that, and how much of a pain in the ass was it? And how did you settle in New York?
It's a huge pain in the ass, you know, but no, I mean, I've always been sort of, you know, borderline obsessed with wanting to be on the right side of that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of people who just don't really give it much thought. And it's like, there are some things in your life that you can fudge on because, you know, of course everybody does. But there are some things that like are essentially, you know, it's not really up to you what happens if they're fudged. Like there is a big bureaucracy in all countries that gets to decide whether you get to be physically there or not. And and you don't want to fuck with that. I mean,
there's no like second chances. Like if you get caught, basically.
Well, I mean, there can be, but you know, because I do know people who have like overstayed and then they've had to return to their home country and then like tried to return and then been unable to, and then like 10 years later and like thousands of dollars in lawyers' fees. So you just don't want to expose yourself to that. I remember when I got my first apartment in New York. I'm moving out from the dorms, like I was in this building in I guess it was Hamilton Heights, like uptown 140s, Manhattan. And the apartment next to me, there was a immigration bust. And it was not, you know, like in the middle of the night and they were banging on my door because I don't remember actually, but they were looking for this guy. I don't know if they found him or not. And they had, in those days, it was INS. These days, I guess it's DHS. But, you know, they had the guns and the where I come from, it's like one of the few places in the world where the cops don't even have guns. So to see like the immigration agents with guns was really like fucking terrifying, actually. And I was like, man, I don't want to be. They don't look like the sort of people you could say, oh, well, you know, I mean, I just did this gig because, you know, I really wanted to work on my record. It's
like, so, I didn't get paid for it. It's just a vacation.
So to begin with, I mean, I had, you know, there are some like legal ways that you could do certain gigs that the school would set up. But no, I mean, I had to live on fucking, not brown rice quite, but like I had an incredibly frugal lifestyle for the first couple of years I was there. And then they offered this thing, which I think they still do, which is called OPT, optional practical training. When you've had a student visa for a qualifying amount of time, you can then have a 1 year work permit to work, to do anything inside of your field of study. So I did that. And then I did the O1 thing, and I got three O1s, each of them lasting 3 years with different sponsors each time. And then I finally got a green card, and then I became a citizen like 3 years ago. And I'd been in New York I'd been in America for 19 years before I became a citizen. I could have done it. I probably could have done it earlier if I'd really worked on it, but it's not easy. And plus, once you've got like an O1 application behind you, the last thing you want to do is start thinking about the next thing. It's just like, okay, I can breathe for 3 years.
Yeah, no more lawyers.
But no, you absolutely have to be on top of that stuff. It's like, even, you know, me is like a relatively easy case. Like I don't have any criminal convictions. I don't have any I've never violated any kind of, immigration ruling or anything like that. But even for an uncomplicated case, you still have to deal with like just stuff that drives you crazy because of like, you have to get everything right all the time. And they can just screw stuff up, and you have to pay the consequences.
Right. It's like one of those applications. It's like, oh, well, you didn't check the box on 25A. Like, we're going to return the entire thing to you, and then
but then meanwhile, we can like lose your application, exactly. And it's still your fault. So you have to just suck it up. There's no point getting what. It is what it is.
No,
it's like, one of those things that it is very much what it is, and it's not something you negotiate about. So you deal with it, and and then of course we came here, and I was like, oh, now I've got to deal with it here.
Well, Joe's already a citizen, so that makes sense.
She is, but that doesn't in and of itself give me any rights. I still have
to go
through them.
Are your children can they have dual passports? Because my son is dual citizen with France because of my wife. Because my wife she was born here, but her father was from Cannes. So she was a dual citizen. So he was, which I think is just a great option for all kinds, to be able to travel freely in the world with two different passports. I mean,
my kids have three. So love. In your face.
Man, motherfucker.
Yeah. And honestly, like they're not many days go by that I'm not thinking about adding a fourth one, because now that Brexit has happened, the UK passport is basically worth, you might as well be written on a drawn on a napkin.
What a difference a decade makes, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I know. But no, it is wonderful, and times like this, like really, really remind you how important that is, because we were getting on the plane and my daughter had her Australian passport. My wife had her Australian passport and I had my UK and my US passports, but, they weren't going to let me on the plane because Australia immediately, that's the other thing they did. They didn't just ban flights from China. They banned any non-citizen entering the country.
Right.
They made an exemption for spouses, but that's it. That's the only exemption they had. And so we had to, the agent at the airport was on the phone for a minute. We had to talk my way in, but a situation like that, it's like, okay. And I'm not like a paranoid apocalyptic person, but you also have to, in the future, we don't know how many dislocations are going to happen to people because of climate change and everything. I want all the passports.
I know. Morocco, Antarctica. Let's just keep
going. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get back into your, sailing the seas and getting to New York. So once you were in New York, and I know this is a question that you probably get at clinics and that, cats ask you, they're always asking like, career advice. How'd you get settled in the scene? How'd you do all that? But you had an extra added degree of difficulty. Now, you didn't know that many people or nobody when you... Okay, and how did you make things happen for yourself? And because I just know that this is a really cool subject to ask, because people, I said, are like, oh, I'm going to move from Georgia to New York. I mean, moving from the UK, it's a whole different thing. And you had to have a decent amount of money saved or just be insane. I mean, right?
It was a sort of a combination of those two. I mean, I had to be insane to go to New York. Well, I didn't know what I was doing. Honestly, like, I don't know what was, I didn't have a sheltered upbringing. I grew up in London, like big city and music everywhere. I used to go to Ronnie Scott's. I had a student ID that was for some of my time there was, what do you call it? Faked. And, but it would allow me to get in those days. You could get it with a student ID from Tuesday to Thursday. You could get into Ronnie Scott's for £2.
Oh man.
And stay all night. I mean, it was nuts. Anyway. I come from a big city. But I didn't really know. I really didn't know just how intense New York was going to be. And I think if I had known, I wouldn't have done it, because I was I was shy. I was a shy teenager, and I was not like a go-getter in terms of like socially, you know, and I'm better at it now, but yeah, arriving in New York, you know, and yeah, so you're right. Okay, so we speak the same language, but in sometimes that's almost, I mean, obviously it's much harder to learn a new language, but it's almost an impediment. There was, I don't know who it was, but there's some literary guy years ago who described the UK and America as being divided by a common language, which to me means that you go to the other country expecting to just be able to communicate the way that you communicate when you're at home. Because you're using the same words or mostly the same
words. You're overconfident. Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps. Or you just think that it's not going to, there's no hurdles. And right. then in fact, you end up getting yourself into all kinds of trouble, you know, in terms of communication by just not really understanding the way that your counterparts use the language and them not understanding the way that you, it took me a long time to learn how to communicate, just like on a, you know, forget music, just on a day to day basis without, you know, while still kind of maintaining my own sort of identity and not just trying to sound American or whatever, which I did do for a bit, but that was just wrong. So, and culturally, you know, like just not really knowing like the things that the references that people have about, you know, just it's hard
to. It's pop culture and stuff too, you know.
Yeah, pop culture, but also just like life culture, like, you know, understanding like how to get a driver's license or what, you know,
right.
It's hard for me even to think of examples now because I've been so assimilated for so long that it just doesn't even occur to me. But there are references.
I would imagine like just going to the DMV was sobering, you know what I mean, for the first
yeah. time. Yeah. Yeah. It does take a bit of time. And if you're somebody who, as I was, like, you're easily kind of set back, you know, any like little challenge sort of feels like a failure, you know, whereas there are other people I've been amazed, like watching other people who have come since I came there. There weren't a lot of British jazz musicians in New York. There's everyone knows there's billions of Israelis and there are quite a lot of French musicians and
absolutely.
And a few, you know, a handful of German musicians and stuff. And people from all over Asia. But there, when I got to New York, there weren't a lot of British musicians. There were a handful, but since then, like a lot have come. And watching, John Escrete, you know, the piano player, he came like 7 years after me.
How about Orlando? Just watching, did you guys come?
Like, Orlando came like 3 or 4 years after me.
Right.
And I didn't really know him in London. We did meet in London, but we didn't play together. We weren't friends. Hmm. But watching the way that John just like came and just bulldozed his way through the scene and just kind of made a mark for himself much quicker than I did was really, you know, impressive and inspiring and a little bit like, damn it, why didn't I do that? But
I mean, everyone's different and
exactly.
the scene might be different too, you know? I mean, like at that time when you came, everything has changed a lot and it changes every few years pretty much.
Sure has.
Or every year.
Yeah, and it will definitely have changed on the other side of this.
For sure.
But so it took me quite a long time, I have to say. Like, you know, I mean, I was always doing stuff. I was fortunate enough to, like, while I was still at school, I did a gig at the 55 Bar with John Benitez, who like started doing his undergrad at the age of like, you know, 33 or something.
Right.
While I was doing my master's, and we played together a bit, and then he called me for gigs, and I used to play at the Zinc Bar with him until like 7 in the morning. And
of course,
and we played the 55 Bar right after Quiver Lutz, who was the owner of the fifth, right after she bought the bar. She passed away about, I don't know, 12 years ago now, but back then it was 2000 2001. She had just taken it over and she was spending a lot of time there and stuff, and I played and I got talking to her, and she immediately gave me a gig like basically one night a month, which I did for like 5 years pretty much. And so I had somewhere to play, you know, and so I could call people that I wanted to play with, you know, and I found myself getting bolder about, you know, who I was going to ask to do things like that. And you know, the sort of comfort level with the scene started to increase, but Yeah, I mean, and as an alto saxophone player, like, you're not really high on anyone's list as a sideman.
It's tricky.
I mean, obviously there are some really successful alto players who do a lot of sideman stuff, and I do now, but
no, I know what then, you mean, it's though. Like, it's like people grab for a tenor sometimes quicker, you know.
Yeah, but like often, you know, like the band leader is going to be a tenor player, so he doesn't want anyone.
Exactly, right.
Or a pianist, and maybe he or she wants like just a trio, like can't afford a horn player or whatever. And then if they do, as you say, it's going to be a tenor. So I was pretty low down the pecking order in terms of just, you know, picking up that kind of like apprentice work. So I just had to make it for myself. And so I had little gigs and I would get people to play with me. I mean, I had on that 55 bar gig, I had like Chris Potter do it a few times, which was
right.
You know,
I've heard
like,
of that guy.
Well, I can't afford to take lessons with you every week, but if I have you on my gig, then it's like the same thing.
It's definitely so motivation, you know, at least.
Yeah, exactly. And then of course people would come down, you know, so yeah. You know, I'd get used to. And people would get used to me and you know, and then it's through things like that that you kind of emerge on the scene. It's like there's I remember hearing Mitsuko Ushida, the Japanese classical pianist,
mm-hmm.
In an interview like year before I moved to New York, like in the 90s, she was talking about, you know, her career and what makes her career. And she's like, there's no one thing. There's just layers of
right.
connections, of relationships, of, you know, people who, you know, like you and want to support you, and people who want to play with you, and all this stuff. And it means that it takes longer and it's harder to develop something than you might otherwise imagine when you're a kid studying. Right. But it's also a stronger thing, because like if you lose one of those things, then you've still got all the other things, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like if you're signed at the age of 19 for some like mega right. deal, and then they drop you 2 years later, and meanwhile you've like already spent all the money and
yeah you know. Or a child actor, I mean, it's very, very similar, right. You know, I mean, if you had this defining moment
like Ben Wendell the child actor, you know, have you heard of him,
the saxophone player child actor?
Yeah. Did you know he was a child actor?
He was?
Like, occasionally, yeah, occasionally he posts like, you know, headshots or like videos.
Are you kidding
from
me?
Yeah, so far still.
What show was he on?
From commercial. He was on like commercials. I think he might have been in a couple of
Man,
shows. I mean, he just
I had no
totally
idea.
Looked the part then.
That's amazing.
You know, yeah, so funny. Anyway.
But yeah, no, it's like that defining moment thing. And I understand a lot of people out of music school have that dream of like their big break, you know, and of course yeah. it can happen to a certain extent. Like, you know, when, you know, Dave Liebman was telling me that, you know, when he got the call from Miles, I mean, yeah, that does feel like kind of a big break. And of course that back then a gig like that actually made people's careers where yeah. they could then, it's not as cut and dry anymore. There's a lot more music that comes out. There's a lot more artists and,
yeah.
Yeah,
and there's fewer people in a position like Miles was in.
Correct.
Who can just hire you, and then, you know, and then you can, and then you're like somebody.
Exactly.
So it's
yes, yeah. and many of those people that are still kind of in that position played with Miles. You know, I mean, which is kind
yeah.
of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, yeah. but
pretty much so, all of them.
Yeah.
Like Matheny.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Mm.
Yeah, he was just a phenom. I mean, I guess Bright Side's Life, he was probably, what, 19 or 20 or something like that?
Yeah, but he still had the apprenticeship thing, you know, with Gary Burton.
That's
so
true.
It's yeah. everyone's coming out of something, even if they're doing it at 19.
Yeah.
Because he was, Burton like, harassing yeah. Gary Burton at, like, 14.
Right.
You know.
It's not a bad apprenticeship to have, you know what I mean?
Yeah. yeah.
So, I mean, what is your advice when you tell kids or students or adults or whoever about, is it basically just what I typically tell people, like make strong relationships, be a friend, like your friends hire yeah. you, or
yeah.
is there more to it than that you say?
Well, it's, I mean, okay. So there's the music part of it, which is like right. take care of trying to be a good musician, but then also it's kind of golden rule stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, be the sort of person that you would want to hire. right?
Right.
If don't engage in things that would disappoint you or repel you if somebody else was doing them, and just have some self-awareness. And I mean, the thing is, you know, a lot of musicians, of course, don't have a lot of self-awareness because they spend a lot of their lives in a dark room, windowless room. You know, it's like, how self-aware can you be if that's who you are? But but you know, you do notice. I mean, one of the things that I noticed right away in New York, before I moved to New York, and I'm not trying to impugn like London musicians when I say this, because it's not really about them, it's more about me. But I had this sense that great musicians must be scary, you know, because they're just, you know, like badasses. It's just like, you know, untouchable, like whatever. You can't, they're too scary to talk to.
Right.
And, and of course, like, you know, some people are, you know, some musicians famously are like not super well disposed to people just coming and talking to them, or not super well adjusted, whatever. There's a great history of that. But I came to New York, and one of the first things I noticed was just like how fucking like nice everyone was. I mean, the people who could really play, there were some douchebags too, but they usually weren't very good.
I agree.
Or they were like quite good, but not good enough, you know, like.
Totally. And that's why they were, that's why they're so bitter. You know what I mean? Because they feel like they're better than someone who's, you know, it just doesn't work.
So there's that way round of looking at it. Like, you know, if you're really good, then you don't have to be like insecure, and you don't have to be an asshole to people and stuff. But there's also, I'm just thinking about it. This is the first time I've thought about this. So you're getting a live brainwave right now.
Oh man, this is priceless.
I think it's probably perhaps as true that the converse is true, which is that the reason some of the people who are really like heavy sidemen and important people in the music, the reason they are is because they got hired a lot, and the reason they got hired a lot is because they're cool. You know, I think most people know some kind of like almost groundbreaking genius that just was like too much of a crank or a nightmare. And absolutely. Just never really quite like made it through to being a, you know, so I can obviously, I'm not going to name any of them, but like I can think of a couple of musicians who I always looked at and thought, oh my God. And like, you know, I'd look at myself and them and be like, that's the difference between like a great musician looking at them and like someone who, you know, can muddle through, thinking about myself. But then, you know, other factors end up just kind of like making it impossible for them to really maintain anything. So just be, you know, like be, and there might be people listening to it, well, probably not listening to it, but I'm sure there are people out there who, if they were listening to this, they would be hearing me saying these things, like, you know, just be cool and like be nice to work with and be considerate and you know, like we are very wrapped up in our own insecure like feeling. Everybody has this feelings about how we think we're being perceived and stuff. You know, so like, you know, you get a bit vibed, or you feel like you're getting vibed by some other musicians. Well, the first thing you should think about, of course you never do, but like one thing you should think about is they might be feeling intimidated, or they might be feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's coming across as like a vibe, you know, but we do, you know, we tend to see things through the prism of like our own insecurities. Of course we do. Everybody does. But yeah, there might be some people who would hear me saying this and think, Will Vincent is saying that because he was like, he vibed the shit out of me. Like, you know, because when I was younger, like I was insecure, and there were a lot of people who felt like they were really heavily vibed by me. I found out later.
Motherfucker.
I mean, this is like a real thing. It was very disappointing and really upsetting, actually, to find out that there are people who now like have a image of me that will probably never be repaired, of like some, of just a, you know, like an asshole. And
Yeah.
And so you don't want that. You don't want that because you may then find out that, like, they've told other people about it.
Right.
Which is how I found out. And, you know, or they called somebody else for a gig or something. It's like, why, you know, it's just, you be the, try to be the sort of person that you would want to have around. And it's easier said than done. I mean, it's easier said than done because you may try to, you may end up trying to sort of mimic, personality traits of people and then you come across as insincere or whatever. So,
no, I mean, I hear you. And it's an enlightened viewpoint, though. You know, everyone is in their own heads and they're freaking out. And New York is very competitive. And the thing is this, it's when you get to the best musicians, the ones that typically they're super cool because they're confident and they also believe in the greater, the community and all the things that they're looking out as opposed to just looking in. Of course, there are some super bitter, amazingly talented musicians who are somehow always super uber protective of their shit and don't want to talk to other people. But that is more rare, you know. As you know, most people are cool as hell, man.
Well, the thing is, like, it may have been different, like when there was more money and maybe more interest. You know, it was just more, you know, more people wanted to listen to this music and stuff. So it's a bigger business because I'm sure there's a lot of pop artists today who are a fucking nightmare.
I would imagine so, yes.
But in jazz, it's like if someone is bitter and feeling underappreciated and pissed off that they're not getting more of the spoils of, you know, you just want to say, what spoils? You know, like what did you expect?
Yeah.
What did you expect? And, you know, you do hear from people who like, look at what I'm doing I have had people ask me, they're like, you know, why am I not? And it's a reasonable question and I appreciate it, but like, what, you know, why am I not getting what you're getting, whatever? And it's just like, well, it's really interesting to hear that because a lot of the time I'm looking at someone else and thinking the same thing.
Right.
And it's like, and then you realize, well, actually, for the most part, if you're of a mind to think about things in that way, then life will give you plenty of opportunities to be bitter about stuff that you don't have
because
there'll be a never-ending supply of things that you don't have.
Man, everything from material things to mental things to goals, it's all there.
Yeah. So you have to just look at your life a different way because otherwise you're going to be endlessly disappointed. It's like musicians who when you're on the road and like there are musicians who are like, you know, there's been a few sort of fads lately of which I have partaken, but you know, like a lot of musicians are into like natural wine, that's one thing, and then a lot of musicians
what's natural wine?
Oh, it's a sort of new wave of winemaking that originated probably in France, but like there are natural winemakers around the world, whatever. Like when you go to France, you can partake in that stuff a lot. But also like foodies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go to France, right?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't lately, but yes.
Of course not. No one's going anywhere. But anyway, so food, you know, like there's a lot of musicians who are like foodies and they like to cook and stuff because they're artistic people and they appreciate that stuff. And I'm one of those too. But it's really funny when you go on the road with people and you're playing like clubs. And you go to dinner to the place where the club is sending you and they're like, you know, sending back the wine or like, and it's like, when you were practicing, playing Giant Steps through the keys, did you think that this was going to lead to a lifetime of fine dining?
Yeah. You were going to like win a Tesla if you could do it.
Yeah.
You know? No, I mean, I'm right there with you, man. I mean,
but sorry to interrupt, but just the point of that, the reason I bring that up is because if you live your life with the attitude like this is something I deserve to have, and anything short of that, if I get it, I'll be satisfied. If I get like a fucking 3 Michelin starred meal, then I'll feel like I'm getting what I deserve.
Right.
If I get the TV dinner that they give you at the Duc de Lamballe in Paris or anything in between, you just feel, you feel disappointed and disrespected. And what, it's just like, man, adjust your expectations.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, for your own sake, because otherwise you're going to live your whole life being disappointed. And who wants that?
That's fucking depressing.
Like, yeah.
No, it is. And it's this entitlement that a lot of people have, unfortunately. I think some get over it if they start that way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't raised like that. And I always was grateful to be able to make a living playing and performing. And I think that the people that are happiest in life, I've got other problems, don't get me wrong. But I mean, in terms of music, that wasn't one of them. You know, for me, like, the audience is king, like, you want to make them happy, you know.
Yeah.
It's nice to be on the stage and to entertain people. And
yeah,
it beats the alternative, which was, I don't know, whatever else.
Not
I
doing
was.
That.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know?
Well, I think it's sort of learned behavior. That entitlement stuff is like, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of, no one I know grew up with, you know, fabulous food or anything like that, or, you know, amazing wine. It's just sort of, they'll like observe and imitate the attitudes of like some older musicians who've been, maybe been on the road for a bit longer.
Right.
And then there's sort of this, you know, the thing develops, and then suddenly, you know, so like if you're Herbie Hancock or whatever, and someone gives you like a Big Mac for dinner before a gig, then you are entitled to be pissed off, unless you really like Big Macs.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't asked them, you know.
But you know, when other people, when like younger people, like, then watch somebody getting pissed off because of the way they're treating, and then they start right. to emulate that stuff. It's just like, come on, man, you're playing jazz. What? I mean, I'm also all for people not letting themselves be taken advantage of, but let's just have
Correct.
Some perspective about being taken advantage of means and what it doesn't mean.
I am right there with you. And plus, like, that kind of reputation, like, if you are a pain in the ass on the road, you're not going to get a lot of calls. I mean, no one wants to be with the person like bitching about the bus, and then, you know, he's like, oh, you know, like, this catering spread, it's you know, they don't have anything that's gluten intolerant, you know. I mean, no, I don't even want to go into that, because some people could have celiacs and that would be terrible.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, but sometimes you have to deal, you know. And
well, that's a different thing if you have a condition, and that's one thing. But, well, it's an interesting like social experiment, like, what happens when you take somebody who, as I say, you know, like, has just spent his whole life in a practice room, and then you put them on tour and, you know, with other people. And I mean, cause, you know, like, we don't know, you know, it's a bit like with social media. It's like, man, I had no idea, like, so many of my friends are like conspiracy theorists and fucking like nut jobs.
Totally.
Until social media, probably they weren't. It's just being exposed to social media.
Or they didn't feel comfortable to say it out loud.
It could be that. But like, most people who have colleagues, you know, that they are in the office with or whatever, they don't know what it's like to like actually live with that person and have share all your meals and like sleep in a bus together and like wait for the shower, you know. So being in that, in like really intimate environment, it's like, it's not normal. It's not a normal thing to do. So it's not surprising that like people, you know, go nuts and start to hate each other and stuff. and sort of maybe like really crave those handful of things, those little perks that make it work for them. And then if they don't get that, then they melt down, you know.
Before we go, I just like to say maybe one thing about the fact that, I mean, you obviously have a really cool solo career. I mean, is there anything that you're planning on doing during or after the shit settles?
Well, I was very lucky, or, you know, yeah, it was good timing. I've had some good timing things happen. One of which was that I like put 3 records in the can by the end of 2019 to come out in 2020. And so,
yeah, that's,
you know,
cool.
Which is good, because it means I can keep you know, the output happening even when I can't really do anything. So my record with 441 with 5 different pianists came out at the beginning of 2020, and then in the middle a Nouvelle record with the Al Trio Mm-hmm. And Kurt Elling came out. And then in November, my new record with a new band called Trio Grande with Gilad Hexelman and Antonio Sanchez came out. So that's great. I just did a project with the Sydney Conservatory down here, where they commissioned five arrangers: Guillermo Klein, Tim Garland, Florian Ross, Miho Zama, and I always forget one. It's not the same one. It's just whichever one is last. Alan Ferber.
Great.
To do arrangements for big band of my music. So we just recorded that, and that will hopefully come out, and then I'll be able to take that music and do stuff with it. Like once the world opens up, Trio Grande will hopefully tour, because that's, it's a band that has some, you know, stars in it, and that's the one with Antonio and Gilad. So hopefully we'll, and it's only a trio, so that will hopefully be easy to do. And then maybe I'll keep going with the big band thing and try to get some stuff happening there. It's not really something I ever imagined I'd be doing, but during this pandemic, I did a couple of like remote big band things. I wrote arrangements and got people to record them there on YouTube, and that was really fun. So who knows, maybe I'll get more into that. And I don't know, man. I mean, when is this scheduled to end again?
I guess it depends who you're listening to. I mean, if you're listening to Fauci, then, you know, we're working at, you know, a long haul here. I mean, I think that they think in America we might be able to vaccinate everyone by the summer, but you know, that doesn't mean that everyone's going to be booking tours. And as you know, you need 6 months in advance for that, at least.
I'm not doing any touring until 2022.
I don't think many people are, you know.
I don't see any point in even trying to do that, because you know, like, you don't want to be setting something up only to then be toppled by like one country you know, instigating restrictions on travel, you know. It's like
what's going to be open, you know. I mean, you don't know that the clubs not everything is surviving, and so we have to wait this out.
I think people have different expectations of what long haul even means. I saw someone post on Facebook recently, guys, when do you think live gigs are gonna be? This was like 2 weeks ago. When do you think live gigs are gonna be back to normal? Is it gonna be like March, or are we gonna have to wait till June?
Yikes.
And I was like,
it's like, oh, you don't even have to, it's just sad to respond.
Yeah. I mean, I did respond, and then I deleted it, cause I felt like an asshole, but
I know.
Like, I'm not expecting to do anything until 2022. And if things are anywhere close to normal, then I will be very happy. I mean, I'll consider that a triumph.
I mean, there's going to be gigs, and there's going to be a lot of virtual stuff going on, like there is now, the live streams, and there will be local gigs. I mean, things will open up in pockets, but like, as everyone knows, like, that's lived in a city like New York or Los Angeles or London or whatever, those local gigs are it's very tight if you're trying to pay rent with them, you know, if you don't have something else going on. So, you know, tours are helpful. Lessons, live streams, if you can manage it. I mean, but I suggest that everyone, you know, considers a lot of different revenue streams options in these times, and just buckles through it. And you know, maybe these new skills that everyone's amassing, you know, will help them actually more when things do open up. Because, you know,
I've learned stuff. I can now make a video with like different people popping up and stuff.
Okay. It's about time, man.
I'm getting better at using Logic and everything. So
and you're writing and doing whatever you can, and raising kids, which is definitely tough.
I'll get around to that at some point. Yeah. But right now, I'm enjoying being with my kids.
Absolutely, man.
And, counting myself lucky at all times.
Right on, man. Well, it was great, you know, catching up, and
likewise, man.
Enjoy the sun and you know, all that Australia has to offer, and we will be cold
like spiders that can eat snakes.
Exactly. What do they have? Do they have like wolf spiders and stuff, like huge ones? What's the?
Well, there's one that they have here called Huntsman Spider.
Is it as big as your hand? Used,
yeah, it's as big as your hand. It's the one. Do you remember that movie Arachnophobia?
Yeah,
it's the one that they used for that.
Fuck that thing, man.
Yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. Fuck it. But they actually they're not harmful.
Right. I think the bigger they get, the less harmful they are.
Psychically, yeah. but there's these little ones around that can fuck you up.
Yeah, that's what they always say.
But there's a video, and I think this must be like somewhere in the north, but there's a video which I actually can't bring myself to watch, but there's a spider that literally eats a snake. So you can Google that and knock yourself out.
It's your moment of zen, yeah.
Down here, they don't have those, but they do have like 5 of the 10 most deadly snakes.
Right.
Here. And they're also like one of them is also the most commonly found snake. Right. So
it's like in your basement. Yeah.
I don't know when to, you know, like I really don't know how afraid to be of this stuff because no one ever talks about it. But then sometimes people will mention, you know, like I was here a couple of years ago and I was staying in an Airbnb and there was a little backyard and the grass was kind of long.
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
And someone came over and they were like, cut that grass, man.
Yeah. There's literally a saying called snake in the grass. So you gotta cut
yeah.
that.
Yeah. I was like, wow, that's real. I mean, it was like 4 inches.
Oh man.
But I was like, really? We're in a city, but no, they can come and if there's grass, they'll sniff it out and they'll come and sit in it and then they'll kill you.
On that note, it was, you know, that I think that's a perfect way to end this. And, you know, man,
that's a metaphor for the whole thing.
Exactly. And you should definitely check out Death to 2020. You'll actually laugh. I mean,
it's cool. Funny. I like Charlie Bucker a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's dry. And, I think Lawrence Fishburne does the MC, you know, part of it. And
cool.
Yeah. It's utterly ridiculous, but it's supposed to be satirical. And I think that you either think it's funny or you're like mad at it. So it's one of those, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think
that's
like it's
life,
funny.
Isn't it? Life is straddling that line.
It's polarizing, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, man. So have a good
cool,
one.
Man.
And
thanks for having me.
No, man. And you know, keep rocking. We'll talk soon.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail, you can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.